Welcome to the Chew Club podcast with Miles Myersko-Harris. As creative director of the Whispering Bob Broadcasting Company, Miles has filmed and recorded over 300 intimate live sessions over the UK and the US, including performances from Jason Isbell, Margot Price and Beth Nielsen Chapman. Miles talks about the filming of these special Under the Apple Tree sessions, many of which take place in an old shipping container turned studio, and about his transatlantic country connections. I hope you enjoy the podcast. I was going to start with Under the Apple Tree.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, so like, how did that come about? What was the, why did that start?
Well, it started originally, actually. I mean, so the little studio that we have that we record the sessions in is actually an old converted porter cabin. So it's quite quite long and narrow. And we'd had it there for a few years because my dad, who is Bob Harris, any listeners out there who might not know what we do, obviously does a lot of interview work and voiceovers and stuff. And we needed a space where he could just, you know, if he needed it to do anything quickly, just go down and do it there. So and because we can't build permanently on our land, it's protected in some way, that we had to get something that was a temporary building, but we could do stuff in. So we put this porter cabin up, and my dad had been using it for, I guess, maybe 6 or 7 years, probably, to put his radio shows together and record interviews and documentary stuff here and there and all that sort of thing. And then I started doing this random internet radio show, which went across a couple of stations, Banbury Internet Radio, back in the day.
Yeah.
And we know a lot of musicians and stuff who tend to drop in and just say hi and things. So, you know, I just thought one day, well, it'd be cool if somebody who came by just wanted to come and do a little thing for my internet radio show. So it happened with a couple of people. I had some a band called the Dumbwells came in and did something. And like Eric Brace and Peter Cooper from Nashville, who are good friends, said they'd just come in and do a little thing. And the Bookshop Band and people like that came in and did various things just for my radio show. And and then I was like, well, I might as well stick a camera on this. It's quite cool. So officially, the first film session was a girl called Amy Spies, who's from East Nashville, who's great. And she's now in a trio with Emily Barker and Amy Rubarth, I think, called Applewood Road, who recently supported Mary Chapin Carpenter. Anyway, so I had a little GoPro, basically, and just stuck it on that session I did with Amy. And then me and Bob were talking, and we were like, well, it'd be nice to start putting stuff online and, having a bit of a presence there. So I stuck it online, and as the studio does sit under an apple tree, I was like, well, I might as well just call it Under the Apple Tree Sessions. And that's basically how it started then. So, you know, once we put the first video up, then people saw it, and some people started asking if they could come in and do stuff as well. It just kind of went from there. So Amy Spies was one of the first. We had Al Lewis from Lewis and Lee came in very early on as well, and Blue Rose Cone and people like that. And it just started going from there. We only did them once every week or two, really, to start with. But now we've done about 350 altogether, I think, and putting like 3 out a week. So it's got a bit busy.
I looked at the number of actual videos and the count. I didn't count them myself, but it looked like 499.
Something like that.
Actual videos.
Yeah, well, we get to every artist that comes into the studio, we get to do 3 performances. They get to do 2 originals and a cover. And I guess if you count up the amount of individual, like separate performances we filmed, it must be about 1,000 now, probably.
Wow.
Some of them don't end up going out until later, or we use them in different areas and stuff. So not all of them are on the YouTube channel and things. But yeah, we've managed to churn them out a bit.
That's a lot of content.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, yeah.
That's cool. And you started to, I don't know how long you've been doing it, but go to festivals and having like a little pop-up studio and doing sessions there.
It's really nice, actually. We've started to do more of that. So some festivals, like we're very local to truck festivals. We've done stuff there in the past, and Cornbury and Cropperty, which is Fairport Conventions Festival. And then from that we would set up like a marquee or something backstage and record sessions in there. And then we've started doing actual sort of program stages at certain festivals now as well, which is fun. So at the Silverstone F1 earlier in the year. And we've got something coming up for Country Music Week in October. We're going to be at Bush Hall, which will be fun. So and now we're starting to do like our own little showcase bits here and there. We've got a relationship with a studio up north where we go once a month and put on artists and stuff. So it's really nice.
That's
really enjoying it.
I feel like from looking at the Under the Apple Tree sessions in the porter cabin in the and actually being lucky enough to go and do a
very good session it was as well.
I feel like
there's some sessions that I watch and they're like big hitters. They're really, you know, established artists usually coming through from, or a lot of the time coming through from the States or, you know, established in the UK. And then you're also really giving a platform to the bands that, or musicians, artists that are kind of coming through the ranks and putting on a bit of a level playing field. And I think that's like away from the idea of, you know, a record label putting money into it, getting plugged on radio, all that kind of thing. It's just a really kind of good thing in itself.
Yeah, I mean, basically the only criteria we have for artists that come into the studio is if we think they're really good. That's literally it. So it doesn't matter whether they've got 5 million Twitter followers or 150. If they're really good, we'll get them in the studio and record them. You know, it's nice actually because it does, you know, you said level playing field and it kind of does do that, I think, because the nature of what we do is it's very stripped back and acoustic. The space is quite small, so it forces people into making it very acoustic. And so it does kind of level the playing field in that way for everybody as well, because it makes them kind of exposed, I guess, in a way. Yeah, and it really exposes the artist and the song for how good they are.
Yeah.
And it's really interesting. We were talking about Sam Outlaw earlier and he came in a few weeks ago and did some songs off his latest album, which has been very well received. But it was lovely because some of the songs on there are quite big in their production and they've got, you know, big drum kits going on, electric guitars and things. But when he came in, we had to strip it right back. So it was all acoustic, apart from somebody was playing a little pedal steel.
Yeah.
But, you know, there wasn't a big drum kit. It was all acoustic guitars and it made it really, really special. I liked it a lot, actually. Yeah.
Yeah, I think there's one that you mentioned, you seem quite fond of. So I made sure that I took note and watched it. It was, I think, Darling Side.
Yeah
that was an incredible session. Like
they're unbelievable.
They're one of those bands, like I don't know if you ever saw Spring Offensive in Oxford.
No, I didn't actually.
A band that has kind of two sides to them. They don't do this is our loud live band and then we've and you know, we try and like work out how to do it kind of mellow or stripped back. They're almost like as good in either mood.
Yeah.
Like, you know, you could have the live kind of, or like more live band version of an album. And also the stripped back one, which would sound just as good. And it's not kind of, it doesn't rely on the intimacy of it. It just is that good a kind of piece of music.
Yeah, well, they're great. They kind of hark back to the old sort of bluegrass stuff. They all sing around one mic and everything. And they actually, whilst they were on the UK tour, they came in and they had, in the video, you'll see it if you watch it, they've got this vintage RCA ribbon mic, which they brought with them.
Wow.
And they were like, so on our live gigs this tour, we literally, this is what we use basically to sing around. So, you know, do you want to just stick it in the middle of us and we'll just do it that way? And I was like, yeah, it makes my job a lot easier. So, with them, they had a couple of guitar amps, which I just stuck mics on. But literally apart from that, it's just that one ribbon mic that's in the middle of them. So when they're singing, you know, everybody leans in to do harmonies and goes back. And it was amazing. But yeah, it's just that's very raw performance that really showcased how incredible their music is. Yeah,
and really kind of being like concentrating on your band as a whole rather than your... like how you're kind of playing, you know, making sure that you're the loudest or the quietest.
I know.
It's everything all at the same time. I saw Delamay do something quite similar.
Yeah, Delamay, great.
I managed to catch them a couple of times. Once in Oxford and once in London. Ended up trying to find a karaoke bar with them in London at one point. But they're, amazing. It just kind of makes you realise the musicianship and kind of... you know, it's not a show. I think they're some of the best players I've ever seen.
Well, you've got nothing to hide behind, have you? Because you know, when you're in a big arena and you've got massive, you know, amp stacks and there's guitars layered on guitars, it's easy to get lost behind other stuff. But when it's just four guys and microphone, it's going to capture everything. So you know, it really is completely raw. But yeah, it's great. I really love those guys.
Which is, I guess, an interesting kind of topic, the whole kind of huge country music arena tour show kind of thing, because obviously in America it's really big, but from going to country to country, I didn't actually get into the arena, but seeing how kind of the scale of that weekend and how many people are going to watch that. Like, have you ever been to that style of I don't say gig, I guess it's concert at that stage, isn't it? In the States? And
Yeah, a couple of times, I guess. I went to see Taylor Swift ago when she was doing, it was, I can't even remember what year it would have been, it was her Red album. So
yeah, yeah.
The album before, the album before, the album before this one.
Yeah.
And yeah, that was, it was at the Bridgestone Arena in Nashville, which I think holds about 18,000 or 20,000 or something. So it's a similar size to the O2.
Mm.
And yeah, that was absolutely huge. But country to country is amazing. It has really become a massive festival now in the UK, and there's so much goodwill and support around it. You know, like they get all the big hitters over. It's funny though, because yeah, I think that's it's starting to happen now. But a lot of the bigger US artists don't often come and do big tours around the UK, or the country artists at least, because I think up till the last few years, they weren't sure whether they'd be able to sell the tickets or whether there was enough of an atmosphere for them. Yeah, but I think C2C is kind of proving that there's, you know, you can get 20,000 people in the O2 in a day to come and see all these country artists. And so it's like Miranda Lambert, she's done a big tour here with Ward Thomas' support. Yeah. Oh, wow. I think everything just seems to be in a good place, and people are starting to realize, you know, how good country music is over here now, which is great.
That's amazing. I think from there's a couple of people having Andrew Combs on the podcast, and from just chatting to people, talking to Della May coming through and things, that it's quite an odd thing to play this country or bluegrass or Americana or whatever kind of label they're particularly under.
Yeah.
And people enjoy it as much as America, but not dance and not move around as much. Because in America, it's like boot stomp.
Yeah, I bet. Getting involved. I know. I think it's just a culture thing, really, isn't it? We're not used to that music coming over here very much. I mean, I think, you know, through the 90s and stuff, the whole, I don't know, line dancing, achy, breaky heart kind of vibe was sort of the prevailing thing. And people didn't really see country music as very cool for a long time. I think that's still... it's still what's holding a lot of the mainstream sort of consumers back, is that impression of it, but it's changing hugely.
Yeah, yeah.
And you know, the music is really good. People, you know, we're talking off mic about Jason Isbell and Ryan Adams and those sorts of you know, burgeoning Americana people who really sort of cross genres in a way and appeal to so many people just because their music's so great. And I think everyone's starting to realize how many different sort of facets there are to country and Americana. Yeah, it's not all just line dancing, you know, well, achy breaky heart stuff.
Jason Isbell, I mean, he may have changed his mind since this interview, but I remember reading that he put Americana, the start of Americana, down to Led Zeppelin 3.
Oh yeah, okay.
So that's where he thinks that Americana
started. My dad talks about this a lot as well, because obviously from being on the old Grey Whistle Test, and he now presents the country show on Radio 2, and people are like, how did you go from, you know, from the Whistle Test to country? Yeah. And he was like, well, actually, there's always been a line of country music, if you look at it, through rock and all that stuff through the years anyway.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, even back, because obviously with Americana, that incorporates a little bit of the blues and all that stuff. And even when you go back as far as Muddy Waters, and the Rolling Stones took their band name from a Muddy Waters song.
Yeah, yeah.
It just, there's strings of it. And obviously people like the Eagles and all those sorts of people coming through and making, you know, sort of crossing the barriers between country rock and stuff. There's always been that thread. So it's actually, if you trace it back, I think a lot of the sort of rock music and that sort of thing has its origins in country or blues or Americana in some way. Yeah. So
interesting. Even kind of like if you come through the Beatles and Elvis, kind of goes back to Sister Rosetta. It's all kind of there in the dare I say it, roots.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, roots music. Yeah, it's funny how you define Americana. Mm. We talked about this with a lot of people. Jed Hilly, who's the sort of CEO of the Americana Association in the States, was just like, roots. Americana music is you know, a genre of music that kind of takes its inspiration from American roots music, whether it's blues or folk whatever. It kind of, so that's when you're at the awards ceremony or whatever, you can go from hearing somebody like Keb Moe, who's really bluesy, to then, you know, Loretta Lynn would be standing on stage and it being really country. Yeah. So it's very inviting in of a lot of different people. I think it's a similar thing with us Under the Apple Tree. I think it's basically, you know, obviously you've got to have a loose genre border, as long as the music's really good, I think they kind of, they accept it, and you know, you can make your way in that way.
Yeah, so if it was kind of electro pop country,
yeah, well, maybe stretching the borders a bit too far. You never know. Yeah,
people get a Korg synth in
there. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it's a defining line.
I can get a really terrible Hammond sound out of one of those Korgs. It doesn't sound great, but it'll demo
quite there you
well.
Go. Yeah,
I think my big step into country or Americana was my friend Mike. We went saying just before we started speaking about my first trip to Nashville, and he'd kind of prepared this playlist and I kind of added in a lot of stuff that I'd been listening to in New York, some electronic music and things, and he very much put in things like JD Messina that I'd never heard of, and just a lot of kind of all the 80s, 90s country music, 2000 country music, because he'd been listening to a lot for years. Yeah. I was really interested, I think, a lot through Rykuda, listening to Rykuda.
Okay.
But that playlist a few months before going to Nashville really helped me to go, okay, I get this.
Yeah.
I kind of, you're starting to get it. And, you know, it's that, you know, three chords and the truth. When exactly. you get into the lyrics, that's like the point, you know?
Yeah,
that's,
it's real stuff. Clever. I think, you ask a lot of people. I mean, it's even funny. At the point of recording this, there's a show that's just been on ITV. I don't know whether you've seen it, starring Megan McKenna.
I haven't.
Who is she's from Towie. She's from The Only Way Is Essex.
Oh, right.
And she wants to be a country music star. And so they kind of follow her, and she goes to Nashville and goes there and tries to write songs with famous people, and they play at the Bluebird and all that stuff. And it's really interesting that it's even as far as that. She said she'd, you know, nuts. For her whole life she's been listening to old country music tunes. Yeah. And again, she and a lot of people who've done very well in the country scene recently, like, you know, Maren Morris and Casey Musgraves and all those sorts of people, are always asked what's so great about country music, and everyone just says it's, you know, the lyrics are about real life and real things and people's experiences and stuff that you go through, rather than I don't know, you know, going into a club and getting loads of drinks lined up.
Yeah, yeah. It's a very
I suppose a few people do that anyway. But you know, it's about proper meaningful stuff, which I think is why it's so great.
Yeah, yeah. Like, I'm not to think that Will I Am is. I'm not going to put him down. I think he's a great producer and stuff. Yeah. But the fact that he wrote, was it going to be the best night?
Yeah.
Wrote by himself on New Year's Eve.
Yeah.
You know, like, are you at the part? I don't know. But
No credit to him as well. He's very talented. Like you say, he's a very talented producer. It's not knocking other stuff, but I think it's just, you know, country music so honest and real.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I think that might be a bit of a draw for, I think, people in the UK. There's kind of a weird nostalgia in the lyrics that perhaps hasn't been, you know, it's not nostalgic in your living memory, but the idea of the big red skies and the boots swinging from a tailgate and things. I mean, there's a line between, you know, someone in their bedroom writing really different country songs, and then there's Luke Bryan singing Dixie Cups and stuff.
But
it's all kind of there in the imagination.
And kind of just romantic images of things, isn't it? Yeah, for sure. Yeah.
Yeah, the American dream is, you know, kept as a dream.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah.
So Under the Apple Tree had its first festival last year at Bush Hall, was that?
It's Cadogan Hall.
Oh, yeah, Cadogan Hall.
That's all right. It's
bad research.
That's all right. It's a hall in London, you know. Mm. It was lovely. It was a little day festival. It was sort of an indoor thing, so we did it in... Cadogan Hall is a great venue, actually. Have you been before to Cadogan?
I haven't, no.
It's really cool. I think... It's funny, actually, because whilst we were there, we were drawing comparisons with the Ryman Auditorium, which is in Nashville, because it used to be a church as well.
Yeah.
Long, long time ago, hundreds of years ago.
Yeah.
But it's got a somewhat similar vibe in that it's got two levels. You've got the floor, and then you've got a balcony, and the balcony still have the church pew seats. Yeah. Although the floor's got, you know, standard sort of seating rows and stuff. But yeah, so it was really cool. So we had the main stage in the auditorium bit, and then there's a foyer area where we had the sort of second stage and had a load of people play. Andrew Combs, the previous guest, was playing.
Yeah.
We had Patty Griffin and Ward Thomas played. Scott Matthews, who's great, Catherine McGrath, who's sort of up and coming coach star here as well, and loads of other awesome people. So yeah, it was really good fun.
That's cool.
Yeah.
And have you been to the Ryman very many times? Have you seen
Yes.
the shows?
Yeah, I've seen quite a few. It's been mainly I normally go over for the Americana Fest, which happens every September, and there's always the Americana Awards show in the middle of that week, which always takes place at the Ryman. So I've been to that a few times. I don't know that I've ever seen an actual sort of tour show there. It's always I've always been for the awards. Mm. I've probably been, I guess, three or four times for the awards show and seen some amazing performances. Last year, my favourite was Parker Millsap, who did his song called Heaven Sent, which is it's an amazing song. It's written in the perspective of a gay guy who's growing up in a very church-oriented background.
Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, the struggles of it. And the lyrics are incredible. And he performed it with Aoife O'Donovan and Sarah Jarosz on backing vocals in his band. And it was utterly amazing. So, yeah that was great. And the previous year, Jason Isbell did Cover Me Up, which is like... just another outstandingly good song.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, so it's always a very special night. They get the great and the good of the Americana scene down there. But aside from that and the standard, you know, guided tour, I don't think I've been to see an actual headline show there. I should get that off my bucket list, really.
I was very close. I've been into the kind of lobby area.
Yeah.
And we asked what was on that night, and they said, in 2 hours' time. And they're like, it's Old Crow Medicine Show.
Oh, yeah.
And we've got one ticket left.
Oh, my God, yeah.
So it was like, my friend was like, you can go.
A fist fight over it in the lobby. Yeah.
They lived in Nashville the whole time.
Okay.
So they weren't that fussed. Right. But I decided not to.
Yeah.
I think we went to the Blues Club instead. But yeah.
I mean, there's 100 good venues you can go to in Nashville on any given night. This is one of the brilliant things about it.
Yeah, doors away from each other. Have you done the Strip?
Like? Yeah. I mean, again, around the Americana Awards is a really good time to be in town, because there's the Americana. There's two big award ceremonies. There's the Americanas, and then in November there's the CMAs, the Country Music Awards, and that's very glitzy and glamorous. And there's a lot of tourists who come into town, and the Americanas. As I suppose the difference in the genres are, it's a bit more sort of not gritty, but you know, it's that kind of it's the more innocent side of things. Yeah, I think it's quite a bit less busy, and there's loads of really cool up and coming artists that play. And they across the week, the festival takes over loads of the venues in town. So that's a really cool time to be there. You know, if you walk down Broadway during the Americanas, like even after the awards show. A lot of the artists who perform go back to Roberts, which is one of the bars there. And like last year, Steve Earle just popped up and played on stage and stuff like that. But yeah, aside from Broadway, you can go down to the Mercy Lounge and the Canary Ballroom. There's even Jack White's place, Third Man Records. I saw Larkin Poe there last year, and that was great.
Oh, wow.
So I always think if there's a time of year that I recommend to go to Nashville, it's always the first couple of weeks of September.
Because
loads of just really, really cool artists converge on the town, and it's a really nice atmosphere. So I've done quite a few of those venues on the late That's nights cool. during that week.
We had the rule that when I went with my friend Mike, as I said, we had the rule that you could only have one drink in each place, and we still didn't manage to get around the place. And it was only like a bottle, it wasn't like anything too big.
I know, literally on Broadway, you walk out of one door and into the next, and it's just a venue literally every door down, and there's music coming out from, 11 a.m. to 4 a.m. It's amazing.
It's really amazing. And we saw the same bassist about four times. I'm like, guys. Yeah. Like, we go, oh, man, I've got like four gigs this weekend. And like, he's just like, that's his every day, isn't it?
Yeah, I'm sure. Yeah,
do you think, exactly. how do you think that side of Nashville, the kind of... it's not kind of necessarily touristy, but I guess it kind of is the on Broadway. How does that exist with the side that is the songwriting side? Do you think? Like, I know it's mentioned quite a lot about East Nashville, or kind of there's the side of people that are doing a lot of songwriting for themselves, a little undercurrent, and then there's the Batman Tower, building, and then there's the side with the record labels. How do you think it all kind of...
I mean, obviously, Nashville is a place... I first went in 2010, and really since even just before then, I guess, but certainly over the last few years, it's the popularity of it's just grown so much. It's amazing, really, how many people are going there and moving there and how much stuff's happening. And I think, as with everything, really, that the good comes with the bad and the bad comes with the good in certain respects. Yeah. I mean, since I first went in 2010, there's been a load more really cool places that have popped up. And obviously, with the popularity of the place going up, a lot of our Nashville friends and people have been doing very well because the market is growing so much. And even house prices. I mean, that's another side of things. The house prices, in East Nashville, especially being one of those places, have just... you know, quadrupled over the last 5 years, which is great if you owned a house beforehand, obviously. But then for people, you know, songwriters trying to get in there now, it's a bit more difficult. Which is, so I think that's the good side of things. And even, you know, the TV show, the drama Nashville has been a huge part of that. Because even over here, it's massively popular. Yeah. And that's been great for the songwriting community in a lot of ways in Nashville, because a lot of the you know, real stalwart songwriters who have been around in the town for ages, people like Mary Gaucher and Beth Nelson Chapman, and people who write songs for, you know, they write amazing songs, have written songs for the series.
Striking matches.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And then, you know, you get people like Buddy Miller and everybody involved in the music production side of things on the show, which is really cool. But then obviously with the popularity, you know, I hope Nashville doesn't lose its heart. You know, there's been stories of, you know, like the RCA studios being knocked down to be turned into condos. Luckily that didn't go through, but I just, you know, I don't want it to go over the tipping point that it starts losing some of those really nice places that have existed there for so long. It just become another big city. I mean, I think it's just about, you know, it's on the cusp now, but it's great that it is so popular, I think, I'm sure a lot of the songwriters and musicians that have been around there have really seen the benefit of, you know, the tourist scene of things, and people selling CDs and selling tickets to shows, which is great. Yeah,
that's the thing, that it feels quite dense of that side. Like like as somebody who attempts, like a lot of people do, to write songs, I don't think I'd ever even, you know, when I've been over there, I would never consider myself a songwriter or a guitarist. It's just kind of something I like to do in my, you know, outside of work. But over here, I feel like, you know, I'm trying to do gigs, I'm trying to get you know, an album together and things. And
I think what's great about Nashville is that people are just completely uninhibited, or they treat everybody in that way. And that you know, if you are uninhibited, you know, and you go to a writer's round, or you go to a guitar pull at someone's house, and you just whack out a guitar and play a song, they'll respect you a lot, just because of the fact that, you know, you have done that that sort of thing. So it's very welcoming. I know it, I mean, I can't speak from the songwriting side or anything for myself, obviously, but I imagine for people going over there, it might be quite nerve-wracking to turn up into this room with a songwriter who's written however many incredible songs. And it's true that, you know, even if you're just walking down the street and you hail a cab or something, and you get in the back of the taxi, and the guy who's driving the taxi is like the best guitarist you've ever seen. I guess it might be quite nerve-wracking in that way, but I think people respect you a whole lot if you just go for it, really. I do think it's welcoming in that way, even though the quality is very, very high. I do think that they'll welcome anyone in, which is nice.
I think so. There's a lot of British musicians that are going over to record and write. Danny Nichols, I see going over quite a bit, or at least a couple of times. And
there's a lot of people. A lot of the people we get in for sessions under the apple tree who are British have said they've been over there. I mean, even Ward Thomas went over to, and the Shires, who've got really great success. Did loads of stuff in Nashville and writing. There's a guy called Jeff Cohen who is a songwriter in Nashville, and he's written with just about everybody. I think he's been in under the apple tree.
Everyone from
Britain. Yeah, exactly. We saw Worry Dolls recently as well, this great duo, and they've written with Jeff and recorded loads of stuff out there. So it is great that they're so welcoming in that way. And now there's the Americana Association UK as well, which is still fairly early on. I mean, it's been going for a couple of years now, I think. But the you know, US Americana Association has never seen it as like a competition type of thing. They've welcomed everybody in with open arms.
Absolutely.
Help promote stuff. So it's really lovely that there's never, as far as I can tell anyway, from my perspective, there's never been barriers that they put up to stop people trying to get in. They're very welcoming, and they, you know, they look after people, which is nice.
It's really interesting. I think, like, you know, a lot of musicians going west to, you know, to record these albums and stuff, we've decided we've gone west to Whitney, West Oxford. That's about as far as our bus ticket can take us.
Well, Whitney's a lovely place.
There's a little studio, a little secret studio we've got there.
Oh, cool.
I think there's other cities in the States that have, like, do you think Austin, Texas? I've never been myself. Do you think that maybe would suffer, or there'd be kind of just shift, and once Nashville becomes expensive or saturated, people that are, you know, don't want to spend so much on a house but want to write music and things might move there? Or Denver, Colorado. I think one of my favorite cities in the States. Yeah. And I think one that was creatively incredibly inspiring.
Oh, yeah. No, it is interesting. I think Austin's in a similar place to Nashville, to be honest, and it is also very popular. You know, I think if you talk to anyone about sort of the country music scene in particular, if there's two cities in America that you'd go to, it would probably be Austin and Nashville. Yeah. It is an interesting point, though, and I think I've heard people talk about it, that for the songwriters just up and coming now, trying to make it in Nashville and trying to live there, it is getting to the point where that is pricing those sorts of people out now.
Yeah.
So it'll be interesting if the prices keep going up as to whether they find another city close to it, or whether there's another little community that springs up.
Because
like in East Nashville, like you were saying, that was because the housing used to be a bit cheaper there, obviously, because it was out at the city centre and stuff.
Yeah.
Which is why all the sort of up-and-comer singer-songwriters moved there and started writing songs and stuff. And consequently, it's a really... I love East Nashville. It's such a cool area. There's, like with downtown, venues every door you walk into of all the houses in Nashville. Every other one has got a little studio or it's all housing.
Yeah,
guitars or all that stuff. So it's a lovely place, and because of that, it's grown and become just a really lovely area to be. There's great little restaurants and bars and stuff now in East Nashville. But it will be interesting if it keeps growing and becoming more affluent. If there's another little area that crops up somewhere where all the new songwriters are moving to.
That's it. I found spent a couple of weeks in Knoxville.
Okay. Yeah.
I think it's 4.5 hours drive. Maybe. Mm. Have you been?
I haven't been to Knoxville. No.
I recommend taking a little look, because what it felt like is there's. I mean, it's a music town, and it's a college town.
Mm.
Which apparently is quite important. In America, it means more liberal, I guess, because you've got some kids hanging out.
Yeah. Sure. Okay.
It's like a cool city, but it has a lot of musicians traveling through that are small enough that their pool isn't that radius to Nashville, so they can't just do a show in Nashville.
Right.
But they can play in Knoxville before they go over to Memphis or whatever.
Mm.
But you can catch some really amazing stuff.
I'll have to look it up.
Yeah, there's quite a few venues there, and lots of bands that seem to be doing their thing. And I watched, I can't remember what it was, a documentary about music in America, and they mentioned that Knoxville is one of the highest murder rates, when in like the 40s, 30s, something like that. That's why it's really dark country, really kind of melancholy stuff.
It's quite
an interesting
place
to go. So being around all this country music or music in general, probably your whole life, I would expect.
Yeah, pretty much.
Have you ever thought about putting a few words together? And
I mean, I do, not so much songwriting, but I do dabble. I play percussion a bit, and I've played a few gigs with people on that side. Now, I do play guitar quite badly, but never started writing. I don't know. I've always kind of thought about starting. Mm. And writing a few lyrics down and stuff, but it's never materialized into anything. I think the place I would do it. And so every year I go down and film this amazing thing called the Chris Difford Songwriting Retreat, which is organized by Chris Difford of Squeeze, and it's partly organized by the Buddy Holly Educational Foundation, which is great. And that's basically a week long thing where there's about 40 songwriters who converge on this big old country house in Somerset, and just spend all day writing songs. And it's so amazing and inspiring that if I was ever to be inspired enough to go and do it, it might be there. But then like in Nashville, I guess with that week you've got the really established writers who've written for everybody and their dog, I think this year we even had somebody who was like 16 years old.
Wow.
He was just starting out and writing, and you get thrown in a room. You get split off into groups of three, or the writers do during the day, and they go off and write a song, and then in the evening after dinner everyone then converges and performs the songs they've written during the day in front of everybody. So again, that can be quite a nerve-wracking thing, but it's a similar situation in that everybody's so welcoming, and it's just a great vibe. If ever I was to do anything, I might just try and tag along on a little group during the day and be like, can I just sit in and try and do some stuff.
You should
I've wanted to maybe next year, we'll have to see.
you've there's obviously kind of a part of you that has the, you know, what's good and or you what you like, and that is quite well, you know, regarded and received with all of the people that you have on under the apple tree. So you're obviously taking in a lot. So maybe it's just
in equal parts. It makes me realize how good everybody is that we get in, like when I sit down with a guitar and I'm just, you know, playing away, and then you get some incredible people who come in and just like, I'm never going to be that good. I mean, it's great. It's very inspiring, and I've grown up around it my whole life, I guess, with my dad being in the business for so long. I basically grew up in studios and that sort of thing the whole time. And I guess it kind of soaked into me from an early age, really. I mean, I do all the sound on the sessions, and whilst I'm part, you know, properly trained as a filmmaker, I've not done even a second of sound technician training. I've never never sat down and done anything. So I'm probably doing everything absolutely wrong, but
I don't think so. It sounds great.
Yeah, but that I guess is just something that it's probably just soaked into me through my life, and just seeing how good all the BBC engineers are. And if I've sat in with my dad on his Radio 2 shows a lot and seen how they work and stuff, so I guess it just got ingrained into my psyche in some way.
And with the kind of, you seem to be very interested in songwriting itself. So like, how, like, what is it about the process that
I don't know? It's just I'm kind of funny, because I my favorite songs all the time are always incredibly sad. I don't know why, but I always think really sad songs. That's why, you know, the two songs I mentioned about the Americanas, that Cover Me Up and Heaven Sent, are both inherently sad songs and very slow. But I don't know, I always just think it's something very beautiful about sad songs. I don't know what it is about songwriting. I think it's just, it's how poetically, if you get a really good songwriter, how very poetically people can say meaningful things, you know, without just saying, oh, I feel crap, the world is awful, or I feel great, what a beautiful day. I just, the way that you get this brilliant lyricists who just come up with phrases and different meanings to stuff and all that sort of thing, I find really interesting.
I think that the kind of idea that the, you know, the slightly sadder songs or sadder melodies, whatever it is that makes you kind of feel like that. John Frusciante said, sad songs make him happy, in this kind of like, oh, there's someone else out there. I think there's an element of really putting yourself on the line with your emotions.
Exactly. That's what I've always found, you know, for musicians, is that if you're writing a song specifically about an event in your life, you are basically just laying your diary in front of people and saying, here we go. So this is what happened to me.
Judge me.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So, that's a really, really interesting concept, I think. I mean, I don't know how it is, how you find it, or how autobiographical your writing is, but it's just, I imagine it's somewhat of a release. But then, you know, if you're writing about something that's really, really personal and sticking it out there for everybody, how do you find that side of things then?
So my writing is 100% autobiographical. Mm. It's all true, even chronologically through the verses. It has to be completely right. And generally, they're little stories, and a lot of them have come about from being in other places. So a lot of them in America, Canada, Spain, and things, of seeing these cultural references or differences that I find really quite interesting. One thing that I've noticed at the moment, which I'm trying to write in a kind of lame way, is the Italian old man sense of style and fedora hat. That is, I don't know, like the kind of nuances like that. Like, there's this little thing that was sitting on some steps in Spain, in San Sebastian. It was a jazz festival, and we were just with the family, and we're sitting having a glass of like €1.50 wine. And this like old, like, gentleman, he's definitely a gentleman, he's not a man, he's a gentleman, walked out with the fedora hat, just like put his espresso coffee cup down. He was obviously there like every day, put his espresso like a little bit too hard. He wanted people to know he left. Gave a little kind of he scrunched up his face a little bit, as if to like kind of like a little chow or whatever, and tipped his hat and was off. And I was like, just in this kind of moment, this cool that everyone always strives for, this old dude's got it. But the kind of noticing things like that, and then just
there's little moments. I guess it's the way a songwriter or a creative person's mind works in a sense. Well, I guess it's the same with painters and people like that, that you can take just even a split second thing and turn it into something much more, which I think is really cool.
I think I never used it as a release. I never sung about anything too personal. Mm. So although there would be personal stories and things, there would be nothing that would be something that I would actually put myself out there until kind of writing a little bit with Kevin Duggan from Loud Mountains. Mm. And he is, I hope I'm not giving this bit away from what he told me, but he kind of writes, even if it's like a bit of writing or as a kind of release like that. So I kind of started doing that just for my own self.
Yeah.
And it was therapy. It was incredible. Yeah. So I think, you know, not everyone's mind kind of works like that. I'd certainly never say that, you know, I would be a creative person. I don't feel like writing songs for me, like, I don't know, it just feels like you have to do it, otherwise I'm going to get sad.
I think that's another thing about the absolutely real great whatever they are, painters, artists, musicians, scream writers, you know, is that it's not something. Even, I mean, obviously they really want to do it, but it's something that they have to do.
Yeah,
it's just in them. They have to do it. They have to sing this song, or they have to write this down, or they have to paint this painting. It's just, something in you, I think, isn't it? I'm a firm believer that I think everybody has something creative in them. It's just whether people choose to embrace it and pursue it, or whether, you know, they kind of prioritize other things, which is absolutely fine if they prioritize something else in their life. But I do think in every person, there's something, you know, whether it's dancing, I don't know, or drawing or impressions or something like that.
Yeah.
Everybody has that little creative strand to them. I think it's just trying to find it and work out how to release it.
I completely agree with you. I think from having a mother as an art teacher, like the whole kind of thread through my life was that, like, I believe her, but she thinks every child that goes through her school has a creative streak. They can do what they can, but the element that some people don't want to do is the practice, like,
I guess it's true,
picking up the guitar, the Epiphone SG for like my 13th birthday or whatever, like, you know, slaving over that because I enjoyed it doesn't feel like work or whatever, but it's definitely one that's really good to focus on and practice. I think a practice, that sounds lame,
no, you're right.
Songwriting itself.
Yeah. I did an interview for a documentary recently with Danny Thompson, who's a great bassist, double bassist. And he played in the folk band Pentangle and all those sorts of things. Anyway, he was saying about when he was younger and he got his double bass and it was just, you know, he just had to play. He was talking about it. And, you know, there'd be certain times where he'd be sitting indoors.
Yeah.
And there'd be kids out on the street playing football, and he was like, "Oh, that'd be great! I might just go out and just kick a ball around." And he had over his doorway a sign that literally just said "practice."
Yeah.
And so if there was ever a day where he'd just been lounging around and not doing very much, and he went to walk out of his room, and he looked up and he saw practice, and he was like, "Ah, damn it, better practice." And then so it didn't matter what he was doing; he'd sit there and practice every day, just to, you know, keep going, which is a very admirable way of doing things. I don't think I've got self-discipline really to do that.
Yeah.
But you know, it's amazing.
It's definitely an interesting one. I think there's the idea of 10,000 hours as well.
Right,
which I haven't read the book, I have to say, but I've been, a few friends have mentioned this. You've got to practice for 10,000 hours before you're an expert.
Okay.
And my kind of always answer to that is, you know, do you practice for 10,000 hours at the
same
guitar,
thing,
or 10,000 hours at musical instruments, then you're an expert of musical instruments. I think it does. I think it really is. It's whether people think practice is a chore or not.
You know? Yeah, I know. Exactly. If it's something that you really love, it won't feel like it. It's always the same. It's like, you know, even with the sessions and with filmmaking and stuff, I just enjoy it so much that if it wasn't my job, I'd still be doing it my spare time anyway, I think. Which is nice.
So yeah, you've got the kind of training in filmmaking. Mm-hmm. So you get to practice that a lot with the Apple Tree sessions.
Yeah.
Do you do anything outside of that for the film side?
Yeah, it's mainly music stuff. I've done bits and pieces here and there, but so we've got a production company called WBBC, which under the Apple Tree kind of falls under, and we make TV documentaries and radio documentaries and things. Wow. We're in the middle of shooting a series of house concerts, which is really good fun, actually. That's cool. What we're going over to Nashville to do in a week or so.
Yeah, yeah.
Which is great. So there's that. I do, like, you know, studio sessions, interviews and stuff. And I have done bits and pieces in the past with various things. Weddings for a bit. I worked with Cancer Research for a while with the Bobby Moore Fund. That's actually one of my favorite things I've ever done.
Okay.
Is filming the Wembley pitch day, which was like a part celebrity, part sort of average punter football tournament on the Wembley pitch.
And
aside from music, football is also my other big love, and that was so fun.
Oxford United fan?
No, actually. Man United, for my sins. I get that off my dad as well. Everyone says, oh, you live in Oxfordshire, you must support Man United. But
yeah, well, that's it.
I know. I did go to watch Didcot Town quite a lot, actually.
Really?
A while ago, but I haven't been quite so much recently. They're in the FA Cup recently. Got beaten 5-0, I think, by... I can't remember. Billy Ricky now.
Okay, yeah. Billy Ricky. Oh,
but,
no.
I know. But yeah, so if I was to choose any other form of like filmmaking, because I absolutely love doing music, filmmaking. If I was to do anything else, I'd love to work on football broadcasts.
Yeah. Oh, wow.
It'd be so cool. One time I got to go up and go to Old Trafford and go into the ITV sort of OB unit where they do all the live match coverage.
Yeah, yeah.
It was so interesting seeing, because you on those shoots, obviously you've got a live director, all the cameramen have got headgear on so they can hear and talk to each other. And I think, I can't remember how many cameras, about 23 different cameras or something around the stadium, and it's the live director's job to be there with his like headset on, and obviously you've got the wide shot of the TV, but then he'd be like, camera 12, pick up a close-up of number 14, come into camera 12 now, and then you're on camera 12, oh wait, there's been the yellow card, switch to camera 13, I want a close-up of the ref giving the card, come to 13 now, and then it's like, camera 16, prepare to get a close-up on blood. It's so fast, it's unbelievable. They have to be real experts at their fields. It's amazing how much, you know, you take for granted watching TV shows, but that was amazing. Yeah. I'd love to be able to do that. But
walk into watching, you know, or my dad's watching the football and kind of like a cup of tea, and he's just been in the garden and he's watching something just to relax, and there's so much going on.
It's crazy how much goes into it. Yeah. Well, TV, you know, as a rule of thumb, TV programs are just massive work and massive effort. If you're doing a documentary, we did a documentary about Nashville actually a few years ago for BBC4, and it was an hour long doc. And I think we had about 70 or 80 hours of footage probably to condense down into that hour documentary. That's so amazing. It's amazing. And all the different facets because, you know, you've got to have somebody doing, obviously you've got to have a camera operator for each camera, but then you've got to have somebody doing lighting, you've got someone sound, you've got someone directing, you've got someone producing, so they're organizing everything.
Yeah.
It's got to be edited and blah-de-blah. It goes on, but yeah. And
so were you behind the camera for that?
That one I was more of sort of production assistant, so I kind of helped on camera here and there. It was quite a while ago now. It must have been 2011, I guess. So I was just generally helping out really on that, yeah.
That wasn't the one with Casey Musgrave?
Yeah, it was.
House concert.
It was. So that house concert was great.
I loved that. Oh, I watched that three times, I think.
Oh, good. Well, thank you. So that house concert that we filmed for that, the way that we've started filming a lot more of these house concerts was that for that documentary, the like end sequence of the show, for anyone that hasn't seen it, was a house concert, which was at Beth Nilsson Chapman's house, the songwriter in Nashville.
I remember.
And so we set up this house concert, and there are actually about 14 different artists, I think, who played during the concert, and we filmed the whole thing, but obviously it was only about a 4-minute segment, I think, at the end of the show, so we only got to show maybe three of the performances and not in full at the end of the documentary. So we were like, well, I mean, we've got like 14 absolutely top draw performances here, filmed really nicely, and so we said to the Red Button, actually, on the BBC, we were like, it seems a real shame to not use this footage. Why don't we do like a Red Button special that you can watch after the show goes out? So that's what ended up happening. So I edited the sort of house concert show that was available on the Red Button straight after the documentary went out. And we got some really lovely comments about it.
Wow.
And so we thought, it's quite a good concept for a series. So that's what we're in the middle of shooting now. So the way we're doing it is we're going to sort of iconic cities and filming a concert in someone's house with artists who are local to that place, and then maybe exploring a bit of the history of the town and stuff like that. So we just did one in New Orleans, which was which was fantastic. We've done one in Austin as well. We're going back to Nashville in like 3 days after recording this, which is scary. Doing one in LA later in the year, and I think we've got another one that we're going to do here at my dad's house in Oxfordshire.
In O-Town.
OX. Yeah. So it's really interesting because as a concept, it's not something... I mean, I know of people that do house concert tours over here, but I think in America, it's a bit more established. It's basically... I mean, it's as self-explanatory as it sounds, you go and do a concert in someone's house. But it's really lovely, I think, because it's so intimate, because obviously you're going into somebody's home, they'll invite their friends over, and you can actually sell tickets to it.
Yeah,
you know, then make food and with drinks. It's so such a lovely atmosphere. But then it's kind of, in a way, it's quite similar to the Under the Apple Tree stuff, because obviously then when you're in someone's house, it's not like a big stage.
Yeah,
so you've got to strip it back a bit, and it makes for really lovely stuff. So Jason Isbell did a performance there, and there's people like Kim Carnes and like John Fulbright, and Beth did something, and it's really lovely. So during the show, we get some of the like local cuisine. Nashville, we had the chef come and do us a big vat of gumbo.
Oh wow,
which was fantastic. We had somebody do like Texan enchiladas for the Austin show, and then in Nashville, we're going to this place called Hattie B's Hot Chicken.
Oh wow,
because Nashville hot chicken is a big thing there. So,
is it?
As
a vegetarian, I wouldn't.
No, I guess not.
No, unfortunately.
Yeah,
but, I wasn't a vegetarian at the time. I should have taken that opportunity.
Yeah, it is really hot. Having said that, so if you're not good with spicy food, being a ginger, I can't handle it very much. Even the mild is like...
Oh, really?
Blows your pants off.
I'm usually a kind of medium spice over here, so maybe I should probably just leave it anyway.
Maybe, so that should be fun. So we're going over there to be filming that soon, which would be good fun. Yeah.
Oh well, that sounds great. I think that's a good time to round off the
conversation. Well, thanks a lot for having me, Johnny. I really enjoyed it.
Yeah, thanks for coming.
No worries.
Cheers.